We're talking about the looks, the expressions, the body language that you are communicating with even as we speak. You may not even know it, but your body is saying something to somebody if they could read it, or even kind of cooler, what could you be reading about the other people in the room that they don't even know you're picking up on? The Body Language Handbook, How to Read Everyone's Hidden Thoughts and Intentions. We'll get to your questions coming up a little bit later on this half hour. So last half hour, we'll take your questions, your calls for Gregory Hartley, former U.S. military interrogator, who is the co-author of this book, The Body Language Handbook. And I want to go back to interrogations, but this time the police interrogations that we see so often on television. I had a couple of questions I was picking up while I was reading this book earlier in the week on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponnett. Body Language Handbook, Gregory Hartley. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. I was watching a crime show earlier this week. I just happened to have your book on my knee, and I was sort of rifling through the pages, and I was trying to see whether the actor did it right. But it got me curious. If you were interrogating somebody suspected of a crime, as opposed to perhaps a military situation where somebody just might have information about somebody else committing a crime, but would you rather be, or who do you think you could detect faster, the truth or innocence of, the guilt or innocence of an innocent man who, an honest person who is being falsely accused, or a guilty person who's a practiced liar who actually did do what he's accused of?
You know, it's interesting. That's probably one of the more difficult things, is the fact that an honest person captured and accused of something is going to have very high stress because of low experience in the situation. A person who is practiced and who is criminal by nature is going to be more comfortable with the situation. So, again, you have to start from that person's baseline. But it's difficult to say that a given person does not feel stress because they're practiced. And I'll give you an example. Lies are easy to catch through process. But when we're talking to someone who is a criminal who's practiced their story, of course they're going to be prepared. They're going to know how to respond. If you're captured and accused of something and you've not done it, the stress is going to overwhelm you and you're not going to be prepared. The interesting piece, though, when you're interrogating these people is there are two things. One is if a person has rehearsed something. I talked to you earlier about eye movement. I'll give you an example of this, and then I'll make a point with an example, if you can bear with me for a second.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah, take all the time you need.
If you're listening to me right now, and I ask you to answer this question, pay attention to your own eyes as you answer the question. And your eyes are with about 90% likelihood going to drift slightly up into your left as you answer the question. That question is, what's the fifth word of the Star Spangled Banner?
Okay, exactly. That's weird. Yeah, up to the right.
Yeah, okay, so for you it's up to your right. That means you're like 10% of the population. 90% of the population goes slightly up into their left.
But I'm left-handed. Does that matter?
It doesn't typically. What doesn't, I know is there's no correlation. The numbers are about the same. But
that's so weird, because right there at that exact second, I actually did it involuntarily. I went right up to, and I did it to the right.
And you're recalling the auditory cues that you've heard. Now, the interesting piece, is when I memorize something and memorize what I'm going to say, there are two things at play. One is I'm going to go to the memory side for everything. So if I ask a conjecture question, if I ask about something that you are going to respond to, you're going to give me an auditory memory. Now, the other piece is if I ask you a visual cue that you should be recalling who else was there with you, and you go to the auditory cue, it's a good indicator that you're making it up, that you've memorized it, for example. And a person who is stressed, their eyes are going to go all over their head to get the facts. They're going to go to visual cues. I'll give you the other example, and you don't have to answer the question, but think about the directions.
Go ahead.
If I ask you for directions from where you're sitting right now to the nearest Wendy's, to include landmarks, some visual references, you'll find that as you try to do that, your eyes drift higher up in your head, but in the same direction. So to the right, but above your brow ridge instead of just slightly below the brow ridge. So we can use that tool then to start to look for truth. It's a really good, handy tool to start to understand by asking a control question, which is what those two questions were. I know the answer to the fifth word of the Star Spangled Banner, and I could verify information about the direction to the Wendy's, I can verify where you go in your head with your eyes when you're recalling information. And then when you deviate, it's a good indicator that you're being deceptive.
Okay. Now, what does this mean? I find myself closing my eyes a lot when I'm recalling information. I don't know whether it's just a sign of intelligence, but I have to picture things. So I close my eyes as though I'm like darkening the lights at a theater so I can run the film and I can look at where I was or how I was. And often when people are talking to me, I will close my eyes, I think almost out of habit because of radio, that I listen better if I'm not looking at somebody.
It's actually relatively normal, and it's a baseline for you. I'm a very auditory guy, so I love radio. It's one of my favorite things because I get more from sound than I do from pictures. Movies, different story. But for the most part, I can turn on a movie in the background and keep up with the story. I don't have to see the pictures. I'm auditory. 75% of people are visually cued, meaning they have to look at something. 20% are auditory, and then there are 5% who are kinesthetic or doers to learn. So our brains anchor information in different ways and segment that information in different ways. And closing your eyes is just normal for you.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I've noticed that my wife used to get really bugged by it, but I've always said, no, I can listen better if I close my eyes, and I can recall better when you ask me, but didn't you say, and then I have to kind of close my eyes and then sort of go back over it in my head. You know, all right, again, I'll go back then to the question of, an innocent man who's being falsely accused, an honest man, innocent man, falsely accused, and under stress. Because in the TV show I was watching, he was giving all the signals of somebody who was guilty and caught. He had flop sweat. He was evasive in his answers. He was doing all of these things, which the investigators thought originally had indicated that he had done it. And I wondered how many poor people in the world have ended up being convicted of something just because they didn't know how to control themselves when they were answering questions.
I actually did a thing for Discovery Channel a few months ago. It was on back in December around confessions in murder investigations.
Oh, I may have seen that. I think I saw that.
Secrets of Interrogation. It was a pretty. They brought to me, I can't tell you how many hours of murder investigations. The interesting piece is we know there are patterns to when a person is going to confess. We also know their patterns for false confessions. When a person is going to confess, they have a tendency to be disgraced, to lower their chin to their chest, to round their body language, and to open up. That's a good indicator, and a good investigator recognizes it and makes physical contact with the person. Now, this is a closing piece, and I'll back up to the other in just a second. When a person is being defiant in their confession, that's usually a really good indicator they didn't do it. So when a person's saying, yeah, I did it, and their chin is up, the chin is a good indicator. When a person has their chin up high, that's indignant. When a person lowers their chin to their chest, that's disgrace. Somewhere in the middle is where you want to see a person's chin when you're talking to them. So that's the confession piece. But if you back up a little bit and you start to think about what's normal body language for the person, a good investigator understands that the most stressed person is going to be someone who is feeling loss of control. We know that loss of control causes the whole fight or flight to kick in. And as fight or flight kicks in, you're going to go to cold sweat, to clammy skin, to loss of blood to the lips and all the mucous membranes. You're going to get to the point that those hormones turn off your thinking brain or your frontal cortex, and you start to respond. A lot of people in a law enforcement situation are mistaken. And I'll tell you, Ian, that not many interrogators are trained in body language, even in my profession, much less police interrogators.
Well, that's a mistake.
It is a mistake, a huge mistake.
And that's interesting because it would seem like, you don't have to pay a lot. Other than your time, it's not like you need to invest in massive robotic machinery or the latest technology. You just have to be able to, read a book, take a seminar, and start to begin to look for those clues differently than what you thought was being presented to you.
Well, we fell in love in the 80s and 90s with technology.
Polygraph?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and a polygraph is a great prop, and a good questioner can take a polygraph and take a person apart. But the key word is good questioner. The polygraph is only as good as the person running the show. And they have to ask questions, again, to get a baseline, just like I did with the eye movement, and then to look for deviation. If they allow or they implant suggestions or do bad questioning, they're not effective.
I think this also goes to another thing I've been kind of curious about, pertaining to a conversation we were having last week about the unreliability of witnesses, that there are many witnesses who very sincerely swear to God on a Bible and are completely convinced that they are, you know, that they have the person, this is the person that did this horrible thing to me, and they send an innocent person to prison.
You know, interestingly, a horrible thing, you just hit a key. Remember, we're talking about fight or flight, and during a horrible thing, you turn off your frontal cortex. So you lay down memories in that mammalian responding brain, not in your thinking brain. There's enough evidence to say that when a person is in that non-thinking, in that responding brain, those memories laid down at that time are not accessible to the thinking brain. So you get shadowy memories.
And yet we prioritize those, and in a legal sense, they get precedent, and so a jury will listen to somebody, you know, yes, that is the person that did that to me, and then later on, when they're, you know, perhaps if that person through DNA is cleared, it's a body rocker. I mean, that person really changes their whole world to think, how could I have been that wrong? And that brings me to that idea. I've always been curious about it. People that want to believe something is true, and so they're not lying. They just want to believe that it's true. They're able to sort of project over their doubt with this kind of inner enthusiasm that, you know, we're going to get this one right this time. And so whether it's a woman that's saying, I love you, to a guy that she absolutely does not love, but she wants to love him. Can you find clues like that?
Well, it gets a lot tougher, of course, but you look for clues of uncertainty when a person is doing that. Now, when you're talking about something like a woman who convinces herself, that's the repetition. That's the long term. Women stay with men who are batterers all the time. And now you're getting into different psychological mechanisms for nurture and how women deal with stress versus men and all of those things. So that's a little bit different animal. But in case of the person who wants to get it right, you're dead on. And what happens with that person is not only are they trying to fulfill a prophecy, but they have law enforcement there to help them fulfill it, and they're getting positive reinforcement for fulfilling it. And that's the deadly cycle that they get.
Oh, yeah. For a witness, especially, who wants to get it right, and everybody's picking up on each other's clues. In the case of an investigator, they're presenting to, say, a witness, and this witness wants the approval of the investigator. They want to feel like they did, that some good can come out of their attack by getting this person off the streets. And the investigator may have a very hard time physically, even if they're being neutral in their language, from indicating which one they want the witness to identify.
Yeah, and remember that when we're under high stress, we look for indicators, we look for messaging from alphas, and we all consider police in that situation to be alpha. The other problem is it doesn't matter how much you're trying to detach, it's the whole human piece. And even law enforcement, when you're dealing with this, there are ways to plant false information, to say something that's not right and get validation by the witness, so that you can short cycle that. For example, when you're talking to a person and you're trying to get a murder confession, it's really easy. I've said to many people in my old business, 3 days I can make you confess to anything, given absolute control. I mean, things you know you didn't commit, because perception is reality. And if I keep feeding you and reinforcing and positively reinforcing, it's what brainwashing is. It's exactly what the Chinese and the Koreans used. But ultimately, if we do it correctly, we can give you false information to validate. And when you validate the information, we know that you didn't commit the crime or that you have the wrong person.
How possible is it to have a Manchurian candidate, a type of person whose brain is being controlled by, say, a captured POW experience? They are ticking time bomb. Only they're only looking for the audio cue, you know, Rumpelstiltskin, for them to commit this horrible crime that they were programmed to do 15 years earlier.
Well, I think the first problem is 15 years is a long time, and the brain does three things well: deletes, distorts, and generalizes. So it depends. I would say if you had absolute control and they were a real computer, yeah, you probably could do it. Because we know we can take away your perception of reality and give you a new one. That's reconditioning, right? That's pretty easy to do. The problem is that reconditioning occurs every day of your life. So as you sit and watch the Pepsi commercial, as you sit and watch the Coke commercial, you're being reprogrammed too. So all those layers, because of this wonderful computer we carry around in our head, are constantly running new subroutines, and it would distort. That's the problem with that idea.
The case of 9/11, there are many people who say that, you know, this is 9/11 is, it was an inside job and the government's lying, and or that they say that there are people that are brought here in this country as youth, and they were brainwashed when they were kids, and they're waiting out there right now to create more acts of terrorism on the U.S. population. As an interrogator, not necessarily as somebody who's a body language expert, but even with that, when you're watching these stories, when you're following these news stories, do you ever see red flags come up about things that the country isn't worried about that you think we should be?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The first thing I would say is look outside our borders to know what's coming. Anything you see as a repetition, anything you see as an MO that is being used over and over and over outside the U.S., get prepared for that. I mean,
give me an example.
How many times have we seen now large hotel complexes bombed? That's the place we should be expecting it next. These guys, and even back in the 80s, and I was an anti-terrorism instructor back in the 80s, everything that we saw is a playbook, just like a football team or anything else. They practice, and they know how to do this. So they can teach this next generation of terrorists, because remember, when you're doing bombings and those kinds of things, the only place people have face-to-face interaction are those operatives, the actual people who are doing this. So it's crazy to think they're going to come up with grand ideas. I would venture to say, and this might sound really harsh, but they got lucky in 9/11. I mean, everything went perfect. It was a perfect storm. We had trained for a generation, our soldiers even, to sit down and shut up when a plane was hijacked. We had trained them that hijackers are not there to kill you, that they're there to get a demand. Well, that was a game changer, and you can see that the culture has changed as a result, and they're aware of that. So they have to evolve. A good terrorist is like a jackal. They're constantly looking at a new way to stalk their quarry. They're constantly changing. They're constantly evolving. But they have to evolve somewhere, and they can't work in a vacuum. So all these things we're seeing outside are the things that we should be prepared for.
Oh, that's very interesting. So that type of an attack, more car bombs then in the United States? I mean, that's the number one thing we see around the world.
Yeah, and they're actually easy to make. There are lots of, when you see IEDs, the kinds of things these people are using, Americans by our nature, we're more than willing to give away rights in response to fear. And we're doing it on a regular basis. We're reducing access to things that they're using outside the U.S. thinking that will fix it. Well, that just teaches them, as they look and say, well, I can't use that, so I'll use this. They find new things, and they'll find a way. The problem becomes Americans need to be cognizant of what they're looking at. And at some point, we have to realize that, yeah, we're at war. And I don't mean by that war on terror, because it's just like a war on drugs. We're at war with ideology at the moment.
Yeah, but ideology is a tougher thing to you can't fight an ideology in that sense. You know, we can fight the people who have the ideology.
That's right.
I want to back up again a little bit to that thing about red flags. So, okay, that's an interesting observation. What you see other places, you're going to see here. But in terms of like, and I'm not a conspiracy believer on this, so I'm not invested in this, but I am curious to see whether you see when our government stands up and says, this is how 9/11 happened, or they say, this is our report, and this is a... Do you ever see in them anything untruthful about the way in which they talked about it?
Well, I will tell you that knowing how government works and how things work, there are two things to this. First of all, the government can't keep a secret well at all. When I hear conspiracy theory, I usually go, it's a lot simpler than that usually. But the second one is they're always hiding something, even if it's how they got the information.
Hmm. So the fact that they're always hiding something, it's sort of like the Alfred Hitchcock's MacGuffin. That the characters were always built around the fact that they ended up in a pickle. They ended up in a place they didn't want to be, not because they were guilty of what they were accused of, but they were feeling guilty about something else. And they sort of by extension, they couldn't bring themselves to go to the police because they were actually guilty about something else, but they were afraid the police would find out about that. So they end up getting caught up in something because they're just so afraid of that other thing that nobody knows about. Well, very interesting. The Body Language Handbook, How to Read Everyone's Hidden Thoughts and Intentions. Gregory Hartley is half of the writing team on this. And what are your questions and comments? What are your experiences on this that you want to run by an expert? We'll get a half hour of calls in for Greg Hartley on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I think almost no matter where you are, it's Valentine's Day, right? Yeah, we're into that zone. Did you remember? You have somebody to celebrate it with? You better be ready then if you don't have a good excuse for why you don't have a present or a card or anything, because she could tell you'll be lying, or he will, theoretically, if you're having to try to come up with some sort of cover story. That is, unless you get some good advice on how to be a better liar, which would be the other way of looking at the book, The Body Language Handbook, Greg Hartley Explains, coming up in just a minute. Your questions, your comments about your questions about lying, your experiences about being lied to, perhaps, or any body language question on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Gregory Hartley, The Body Language Handbook. We've got a question from Alan in Frederick, Maryland on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Alan.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Hartley. I'm curious, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Revised says that up to 4% of the people are sociopaths, and I'm sure there are levels of sociopathy, but if someone's a stone-cold sociopath with no guilt, can they evade interrogation?
You know, interestingly enough, one of my favorite books is Robert Hare wrote a book called Without Conscience, and he's the world's foremost expert on psychopathy. And he actually, you know, regardless of whether or not they're a psychopath, that means they feel no remorse for you. That still does not mean they don't feel remorse about getting locked up. There's not a remorse. There's an apprehension piece. So what we rely on with those kinds of people is they're really good liars. I mean, face-to-face, they can lie as well as anybody on the planet because they don't feel any compunction. But if they feel like they're going to get caught, they still show signs of stress and fight or flight. That's how you find them. Plus, liars can only, they only lie in three basic ways: omission, commission, and embellishment. And if you can take a process approach to getting each of those to break, you can take people apart.
I see.
So their body language is better than average. They do really good eye contact, and these are people I refer to as glossy, and you referred to one of those earlier who looks like he's got the perfect hair and the perfect this and the perfect that.
Right, John Edwards.
Most of those people, when you find that, I refer to those as glossies, kind of like an 8x10,
right.
And they're Teflon folks, and they're just, that makes me uneasy when a person is just too perfect.
You know, who's, I think a great example of that, at least in fiction, is Hannibal Lecter, mm-hmm. in The Silence of the Lambs, in any of those movies, that he gave the air of somebody who was being incredibly honest, but obviously he had no empathy for any of the victims, except oddly enough, he ends up having that, you know, that attachment to Clarice Starling. But I think that character played very well and was conceived perfectly to illustrate that.
Right. Right. And psychopaths just feel no compunction about doing anything to anyone else.
If they want it, they
That's
take
right.
it.
That's right.
Michael's in Eugene, Oregon, west of the Rockies for Greg Hartley, The Body Language Handbook. Michael?
Hey, I have a comment, and then I have two great questions. That was interesting what you're talking about. I'm so impeccably honest that people are find me unbelievable. It's interesting. I was wondering, judges in the criminal court system, they would seem to have some training in body language, and also, and if they don't, they need to. And also, has there ever been a case where a police officer has ever been requested to take a lie detector test?
A couple of things. The first one is, if you think about the purpose of most judges, is to ensure process is right, and ideally we would prefer that our jury members all knew body language. But the idea that a judge could probably... One of the best things for people is if you open your eyes, and the approach I take with all of the books is I try not to tell you absolutely this means that, but try to give you a skill set that says use your daily life. You're in the biggest lab in the world. Some people beat me up for that and say my books aren't detailed enough, but I believe any person taught basics can learn more and more and more. And judges, if anything, are like police officers. They're looking at people who, in a lot of cases, are guilty, so they start to get jaundiced. So most judges, I would say, aren't body language trained.
And cops take lie detector tests all the time.
All the time. Yeah, that was my next comment.
Yeah. But I'm going to go back to what Michael's first comment was. where he said he's so incredibly honest that people find him unbelievable. But I thought that was an unusual opening statement. Where are you with that?
You know, when I hear that someone's unusually honest, most people, there's a book a few years ago called Radical Honesty. Some people find that to be a great process to say whatever it is that's on your mind. For my taste, I prefer that you don't, primarily because it's so disconcerting for us in our modern world that it's a difficult lifestyle to maintain.
And I'm here, and I'm sure Michael is one of those few people who is radically honest and means it. But I know some people who I'll give you Sarah Silverman as an example. Do you find her funny?
Bizarre funny.
The comedian. I think she's great. I think she's hysterical.
Yeah.
In a bizarre way. Yeah, exactly. But she has this reputation amongst her fans as being this radically honest person who says anything that comes to her mind. I think she's hiding something so mammoth. You know, I think that there is something about her that it's almost like it's such a great offense that I think, wow, what is she defending?
Right. You know, well, and it is a good smokescreen in some people. And I try, you know, quite honestly, you know, I try not to be judgmental of those folks until I dig in a little. But when I'm face-to-face, I will have a natural tendency, like you do, to say, wonder why they're being that honest. Because most of us, I mean, if it depends on the part of the country you're in, it's perfectly acceptable to say whatever you think or it's not. In some cases, it's an art form. I live in the South. If you're in the Midwest, I've worked in and out of Minnesota. Minnesota nice is a wonderful thing. If you're in Georgia, we have our own version of it. We say what we mean, but it's very shielded.
Well, you know, it's funny. I lived in the South more years than I've lived in the Midwest. And I love actually the difference between the two. Minnesota nice is its own facade. It's sort of similar to the traditional Southern say something mean about somebody and then end it with bless your heart,
right.
You know, and it, so there's a correlation between that. And I mean, I kind of dig Minnesota nice in some respects, but it's also really passive aggressive.
Yeah,
and in the South, there's a different kind of, I mean, there was a level of candor, for example, when I lived in Atlanta for many years, and I loved the level of honesty that people were having about race conversations. And you could really, in a lot of cases, you could just have this sort of brass tacks right out of the box. This is how I feel. What do you feel? And it's harder in other places where they consider a conversation like that to be really offensive. To even want to have the conversation can be off-putting. Well, so it does have a cultural context, the level of honesty.
Yeah, I think so. And in some places, people consider themselves very honest. And if you were to get to brass tacks like the military kind of honesty, entirely different culture.
Right. Garrison is in eastern Iowa on Coast to Coast for Greg Hartley. Garrison?
Yeah, I had a question. I'm a dog handler, and my dog is, I consider an expert at reading body language. And I've owned horses before, too, and it seems like animals know a lot about their body language. Is there anything we can learn from animals or anything that you've involved with animals?
You know, I, oddly enough, I have dogs and horses, and you're right. They communicate effectively. Often, as I write about things I've learned from my dogs and from my horses, because they are keenly attuned to your body language. Your words mean nothing. Your tone means everything. If you tell your dog, "Hi, it's good. What a wonderful dog. I'm going to shoot you today," they have no idea what that means.
Right.
But they clearly understand your tone of voice. And dogs are good at other things. There is a chemical change that occurs in your body during any fight or flight. When you're afraid, you know, we say dogs sense fear. They absolutely do. They smell something different. And they know when prey is afraid and about to bolt. So is there something we could learn from? Sure. I think we could easily overestimate that a dog is a good judge of character, because a dog could make a poor decision about character based on stress and all other things because of how they decide things.
But your dog does know when you're lying.
Well, you know, dogs don't care if you're lying.
And they don't care if you're lying. Better said. Wildcard line, Lance is in Kansas on Coast to Coast for Greg Hartley. Go ahead, Lance. Lance? Lance once, Lance twice. And we go to Lisa in California on Coast to Coast for Gregory Hartley. Lisa?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Gregory. Hi, Ian. Okay. I have a roommate who is, like, I think he's a sleazy Hollywood type. He's in the business, and he's always, like, dropping names and talking about how hard he works and all this stuff. And he invited me to this party, and he's never invited me to a party before. And then the next morning, he asked to borrow my computer. And I wouldn't let him because I have sensitive files on my computer. And after that, he, like, didn't talk to me. And this was, like, 3 days ago, and the party was tonight. And then he just didn't tell me where it was. And I want to know how to know if he's for real. Like, is there anything I should look for? If he's, like, dropping names and talking about how hard he works all the time. And is that an indicator that he's really just, please?
Well, there are no really, as I said before, there are no absolutes to say a person's a sleaze. The question you'd have to ask is start to link things together. When a person makes up a lie, typically they make up a snapshot that doesn't tie into the rest of their album. So those lies are not supported by any facts. They're not tied to details. And typically when we think of someone committing an outright lie, we just ask details and it falls apart. That's cover stories fall apart. And when you see things like Bourne Supremacy and those kinds of things, all the Hollywood kinds of spy movies, cover stories fall apart because no one can make up enough details to tie a cover story back in their life. They have to live it.
Does that help, Lisa?
I will maybe delve a little bit deeper and see if his cover stories fall apart, right?
Greg,
just ask him questions.
Yeah, what question would you have Lisa ask him? What? How would you have her explore that?
Okay, baselining eye movement, for example. You know, he told you about the party but wouldn't tell you where it was at. If you go and talk to him and you say, hey, tell me about the party last night, and he goes, well, first of all, ask a control question. Hey, when was the last time you saw this? I misplaced something in the house. And if you know that he will give you a right answer, then look for a baseline normal. So if he goes left for that, then say, hey, who was at the party last night? And if he goes right for that, you got a deviation. Good indicator.
Okay.
That helps?
Very.
I think it would be worth picking up the body language handbook. It's available everywhere, too, and that will give you more to work with. Sybil is in Las Vegas on a wild card line for Gregory Hartley on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Sybil.
Okay, be patient with me because this is going to be a question.
Okay.
I was a food server a while ago, and I had a coworker, a female food server. And from the very time I started the job, and I didn't care, but I was just couldn't understand why she was this way with me. From the very beginning from the job, she never said hello, ever spoke to me, ever. And she was always saying how people were discriminating against her jokingly with the other coworkers that she was friends with. She was from, like, South America. And as a food server, we're supposed to help each other carry the food when we're not doing anything. If somebody else's big tray of food is there, you're supposed to, that's part of your job, you're supposed to carry the food out. So I noticed I was carrying her food out, you know, and she would never be carrying my food out. She'd be sitting around talking or sitting on her butt. So this one night, I'm carrying her food out, and she's sitting on the counter with the male supervisor in between her legs, if you can imagine. Her legs are spread. He's in between her legs. They're flirting, rubbing each other. She's sitting on the same counter that this male supervisor tells me I can't sit on because we're not supposed to. And I walk by, and I've got this big tray of food, and I'm old enough to be her mother, okay? And I have this big tray of food, and I say, you know, Eva, I've got your food here. I'm taking out table 14. And she just sits there and looks at me, doesn't say thank you. And the supervisor just looks at me and kind of his eyes go to the right. And I would like to know if you could tell me, I still get mad about it when I think about it. My comprehension was that she was either jealous of me and as a result, a coward and got off on watching me do her job. From her body language, can you tell me at all what you think she was doing with me? Because I have a problem with women like this in my life that are really weird with me for no reason.
Sure, let's find out. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's difficult to say sitting here, but, you know, the things you just said, it surely sounded like some connection to the supervisor a little better than is naturally expected in that role. The other piece is when he broke eye contact, that's probably a recognition of wrongdoing and letting her get away with that, right? That's his role. That's not the problem you're talking about here, Sybil, is you're talking about entitlement. Where you feel like you have an entitlement and where she felt like she knew you had an entitlement, so her body language is excusing, is probably what you were seeing, her kind of blowing you off. But entitlement is a big discussion. People don't even discuss entitlement in real relationships, much less at work. So I think what you're seeing is someone violating your entitlement, and that's why you're feeling frustration.
How about the fact that...
Can you help me understand? I don't understand my entitlement that she was supposed to be doing her job and she wasn't, and she comprehended that I knew that about her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So when she's excusing with her body language or defiant with her body language, it's because she realizes that that's her job and you're carrying her food while she's sitting there probably doing something inappropriate, would be my guess.
Well, and she has triangulated the authority figure. She's triangulated the alpha, so she's controlling him.
Through association, yep.
Yeah, using her sexuality or, you know, perceived sexuality to control him, and doing what a lot of people do, which is making their jobs easier, just trying to lower their own stress level by involving somebody else in their life. But here, I want to go back to what she said at the beginning about not saying hello, not using social pleasantries. There's a person I work with who does that a lot and just will have conversations with you, but they're never symmetrical to the social norm of a conversation. So, you know, I'm not a big fan of small talk, but I do believe in hellos, how are yous. Hey, by the way, I really like how you're doing your hair. That's great. That kind of a thing. And they absolutely, they will stare at you and make you feel uncomfortable for having done something so pedestrian as to say, hello, how are you?
Is that consistent across all of the people they deal with, or is it just with you?
That's my impression that it is. But what if it, is there a difference? If it were just me, what would that tell you? And if it were everybody, what would it tell you?
Well, if it's just you, you're being dismissed or they're casting a judgment at you. If it's everyone, a lot of people are in arrested development socially. And by that, I mean, at some point, they thought that was cool in the 80s when it was cool in a movie, and they started to practice it, and they were rewarded for it. And what happens with people like that is they get into a cycle, and they consistently deliver that same message, and they're consistently rewarded for it. And we don't call people out often enough, Ian, on being just that kind of a person.
Yeah. Let me get to Roger real quickly, who's waiting the longest. And Roger, just gonna have to keep your question really simple and quick, okay?
Yeah. I just wanted to say, I think you have a real field day every time, like, a president such as Obama gets on the TV and gives these speeches. What do you make of all the times he gets on and says, listen to me? Listen to me.
That's great. And a lot of people did that during the campaign, Republican or Democrat. But good point, where he says, listen to this.
Well,
what does that mean to you?
That's the verbal equivalent of beating you with a baton and saying, listen, you little people, you need to understand this. And I think you hit it, Ian. A lot of people did this during the campaign. They're feeding us information in a paternal manner because we don't seem to be intelligent enough to consume it.
Almost a sign of disrespect even before they say what it is. Very good. The Body Language Handbook, How to Read Everyone's Hidden Thoughts and Intentions. Gregory Hartley, thank you so much. Enjoyed this tons. Look forward to having you back on again in the future.
Have a great weekend. Pleasure to be here.
Happy Valentine's Day, for whatever that's worth to everybody listening out there. And remember to think of that person in your life. Just because you haven't done a Valentine's card in the past doesn't mean you can't do one today. Have a nice day out of it. We'll talk to you tomorrow night. The smiley face killer update that so many of you have asked for. It's gotten curiouser and curiouser. Deus te amat, and I do too.